there are some reservations. Anytime you enter into an agreement with a country that's completely against the United States, an adversary, it's not going to be a situation where we get everything that we want. Those are political talking points. He probably got those directly from some sort of the RNC or somebody like that. And that's my problem with it. He doesn't know anything about this deal. I'm sure he hasn't read it. That is, so when he comes to it from that perspective, he's just, you know, they say we want a better deal. From what? They weren't in those internal, very extensive talking between the two leaders and the different leaders within the country. He wasn't in any of those negotiations. He has no clue. The reality is that there is no country in the world that's been this close to gaining a nuclear weapon and not gotten one. So the reality is, can we prevent the Iranians from getting a nuclear weapon if they want one? Probably not. Short of like a full-scale invasion or something like that, nobody wants that. And so then what we have to do is turn a pariah state and convince them to rejoin the family of nations, and that's at least what they've done in part here. They've engaged not only the United States but European powers, and they've dedicated themselves to say, we want to be one of the members of these family of nations and not a pariah nation. That's where the real advantage of this could be. We can open the door. Do I have reservations about $100 or $150 million going into the Iranian system that they could be used for state-sponsored terror like they have in the past? Of course I do. To say, like Mr. LaHood was saying, about 5 or 6 years. Is he serious? That's not even on the table. The Iranians would have walked straight away. They would have done all of their planning and their development on their own, and they would have acquired a nuclear weapon, and nothing would have been – there would have been no international pressure to stop them at that point. The other thing about it is, and this is a very alarming part of the deal, which is the Iranians actually acquire more conventional weapons. That's one of the problems, because there's an embargo on some of those weaponry now. The problem the United States has is most of those weapons come from China or Russia, and they could have done those unilaterally. And so it's not a case where we could have even prevented that with sanctions.
Those are reservations. Are those deal killers for you?
No, I wouldn't say. Anytime that you deal with a nation such as Iran that is a sworn enemy of the United States, it's going to be difficult. Nothing like that necessarily should be a deal killer. The fact that there's going to be, at some level, opening up Iran to inspectors is a start. The fact that the Iranians are actually at the table with the Americans and the Europeans, that's a significant change and start from the past. The Ayatollah is the one who really controls Iran, and the fact that he allowed that to happen says that not only were the sanctions working, sanctions that President Obama put in place, by the way, but that they want to be a member of the family of nations and be considered legitimate, because they have very significant regional goals in mind. They want to expand their influence. Now, I know that's a concern as well.
In fact, that is a knock on this agreement, that it doesn't do enough to rein in their regional ambitions. They're meddling in the Kurdish area with ISIS in Syria, Lebanon, and the Gulf states, the shadow conflict they have with Saudi Arabia. How could that dynamic have been curbed by this agreement with a little more effort?
Did the sanctions curb their ambitions? I would say not. They had those ambitions irrespective. Here's the other thing that we have to realize. If we consider ourselves a very close ally with the Saudis, for example, because they're not belligerent to the United States, but the Saudis have a very traditional view of Sharia law that they are trying to impart on other nations and influence other nations. And that Sharia law that the Saudis have is far more severe in terms of punishments and so forth than the Iranian-style system. So there are nuanced arguments to this that, of course, a soundbite that most of the other candidates that are running for president and Mr. LaHood are using reach none of that.
The extrapolation, though, from the idea that the kind of Islam practiced in Iran is less hostile to the U.S. than the kind of Islam practiced by the leaders of Saudi Arabia, neglects the three decades of history that has painted the U.S. as the great Satan in Iran. It's not as if...
Well, in your, statement, you were talking about hostility to the United States, which I did not mention any hostility to the United States outside of... I was saying that their view of Sharia law is more traditional in nature and far more punitive I wasn't speaking.
But the extrapolation, though, is that it might be more feasible over the long haul to get Iran as an ally in the region than it is to expect Saudi Arabia to remain an ally. And that has been an argument advanced by some Democrats. I realize that you didn't specifically articulate that.
And we're nowhere near that point. But I've heard people say that, and not just Democrats. I've heard scholars and stuff say that if you look at the Iranian culture, for example, it's far more in line with Western ideals than the Saudi culture. And you know, Saudi Arabia is in a very difficult circumstance because they're a very wealthy nation, but they spend exorbitant amounts of money on defense and these efforts to try to expand their version of Islam. And so the fact that this deal, which many people don't realize, will add tons of new oil into the system, and that will hurt the Saudi economy. The Saudis really are not in a position right now where if they got into a nuclear arms race, they're not interested in spending more money on defense than they already spend, which they would have to do. So in this case, even though it would expand out the Iranian influence, which the Saudis definitely are combating across the Middle East, they're not completely against it because of that reason. They don't want to get into a nuclear arms race, and they realize that if the Iranians did acquire a nuclear weapon, that's exactly what would happen. And that's the last thing that we need. We need to take every measure we can to make sure there's not a situation of nuclear proliferation in the Middle East.
Does this agreement make Iran more stable with a hostile regime?
I don't think it makes Iran more stable. I think what it does is it tells that the leaders who had been a pariah nation before and still are, but are moving in a direction to a more normalized relation with the rest of the world, and I think that aspect of it is positive. Can we trust them? Of course we can't. You know, they made it clear that they do not recognize Israel and could wipe it off the map if they had the opportunity, they would. You know, they say comments like that. But the vast majority of Iranian people don't share that view. You know, the clearest way that you can see that the Iranian culture is more progressive than the Saudis or any of the others in that region, for that matter, is how women are treated. And women are treated far better and have far more power and authority in the Iranian system than they do in Saudi Arabia.
This does not equate to eventual rapprochement, though.
Not necessarily, because we know that the average person in Iran have, in certain cases, have risen up against the government and there's been crackdowns. So we know that's definitely the case. So we still have a dictatorship in that regard, and that's who we're dealing with. We're not dealing with, on a political level, the vast majority of Iranian people, but we also don't want to ostracize them and alienate them when they have a propensity to at least be open to Western ideals.
How can we, having given away this leverage for what most people hope is an end to their nuclear weapons program, even if they keep a civilian nuclear program, how can giving away that leverage help us tackle their regional ambitions and their sponsorship of terrorism? How do we advance on that part of the agenda then?
Well, I think we weighed the options and we said that the most significant threat in the region was nuclear weapons, and so that's what we used our leverage to go after. If we would have said, you know, you're close to reaching a nuclear weapon, we are more interested in your state sponsor of terror, and we used the pressure that we had on them to go after that, we could have. But what we've done is we used the leverage that we had to go after nuclear weapons. That is correct, by the way, because there are too many organizations and too many governments in the Middle East that are unstable, and with the proliferation of nuclear weapons in the Middle East, that would have been a nightmare for the future, not only of that region, but of the entire world.
Your argument, then, is that this is the best deal possible with the the chips we had to bargain with?
Well, my argument is I really don't know because I wasn't in those negotiations. It wasn't a negotiation just simply between the United States and the Iranians like a lot of people like to assume. There were other pressures from the outside, from the Chinese and the Russians. They could have lifted whatever sanctions they had on conventional weapons at any time.
It is fair to ask you, though, if you were in office today, since you're running for office, how you would vote if you were there.
I think I'd have to listen. You know, I'm very open-minded in that regard. I would lean towards accepting it because I think diplomacy is a better option than, like, military force. But I would have to actually be engaged in all of those conversations and the briefings that we would receive. That's what people want a leader to do anyway. They don't want someone to go in there and say, well, this is what I would, irrespective of what facts are presented to them. I would make my decisions based on fact. If I saw something, like you mentioned, the $150 million, would that be a deal breaker? Well, it could be. You know, if I saw exactly how they would use it, and I think that that would be something that we need to prevent, then it could be a deal breaker for me. But I need the information before I make decisions. Very few politicians actually function like that today.
Did the administration screw up by putting this to a UN vote before setting the deal before Congress?
I mean, remember, it's not just the United States that was involved. A lot of European nations were involved in it as well. There was pressure not just from the United States but from others. That's a decision made by President Obama. I doubt, you know, he probably made the decision because he knew for political reasons, you know, and here's the greater problem. You know, we're dealing with situations. Everything's political now. Every single thing.
Hasn't it always been?
No, I think there's been a time where when there was less influence from special interests, where we had statesmen and people made important decisions. I mean, we've heard of all kinds of situations in the past, even where Tip O'Neill and President Reagan were really good friends in that regard and could work things out on their own. I don't see that today. Everything is so politicized. It's like if President Obama came out and said he was for Dasani water, every Republican in the country would start drinking Aquafina. It's silliness. And when we deal with this situation with Iran, we should be all pushing in the same direction instead of trying to get political points. Now, you mentioned the presidential race. That has really just muddied all of these waters. Because in a presidential race, these presidential candidates want to appear as strong as possible, make these really strong statements, you know. And so that's what's kind of muddled this conversation as well. But this is one in particular where we have to be pushing in the same direction to make sure that the Iranians don't get a nuclear weapon. Because if we have nuclear proliferation in the Middle East, that is bad news, like I said, not only for that region, but for the entire world. And I make a comment. I'm a teacher, as you know. And there's something I'm really afraid of. And I say, just because technology is the way it is today, communication is so fast today, that I could see a time where somebody could craft some sort of crude nuclear device, and there'll be a time within our lifetimes when a city around the world, I pray that it doesn't happen, but is basically one of these bombs is detonated in one of those cities. I just think that with the proliferation of nuclear materials, it's almost inevitable. It's so sobering and scary for me. I think if we can try to rein it in, we have 9 nations in the world that have nuclear capability. And so if this moves in that direction to keep that number at 9, then I think that, you know, I would be supportive of the deal.
Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker is campaigning for State Senator LaHood. Walker has, of course, opposed prevailing wage legislation. Most past Republican congresspeople in the 18th District have supported prevailing wage legislation, including Ray LaHood, Bob Michael, and even Aaron Schock. Where do you stand on that?
I believe that a worker has an absolute right to have some say in what they get compensated for their labor. And when labor unions, through collective bargaining, are able to raise the overall wages, it doesn't just affect the labor union in question. It affects all the labor in the entire area. Prevailing wage is a good protection of that. I'm a strong proponent of collective bargaining in every regard. One of my major issues that I like to talk about all the time is the income inequality in the country. I'm not saying that everybody should make the same amount of money. That's not what I'm saying at all. But the vast majority of middle class has seen their wages freeze for the last 30 years while the cost of everything else has gone up. One thing that could change that in a significant way is if more people had collective bargaining rights. If they had that ability, it would raise the overall wages. And you mentioned Scott Walker with Darren LaHood. I mean, that is a clear message that's being sent, a very anti-union message, anti-collective bargaining, anti-worker message. And so if you're a worker out there, I wouldn't wait to September the 10th. I would go down to my local courthouse on August the 3rd and cast a ballot.
Rob Mellon is the Democrat running in the 18th District Special Congressional Election September 10th. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Charlie Schlenker.